and slit the band of the hat at the rear, and cut through the brim, and opened up the crown, and then set the hat on his head, and looked up at Tobin and the kid. "Come down," he said. "Come down and share this meat." They didn't move. Toadvine already had a piece of it in both hands, and was tugging at it with his teeth. It was cool in the well, and the morning sun fell only upon the upper rim. The judge scooped the remaining coins back into the satchel and stood it aside and bent to drink again. The imbecile had been watching its reflection in the pool, and it watched the judge drink, and it watched the water calm itself once more. The judge wiped his mouth and looked at the figures above him. "How are you fixed for weapons?" he said. The kid had set one foot over the edge of the pit, and now he drew it back. Tobin didn't move. He was watching the judge.
"We've just the one pistol, Holden."
"We?" said the judge.
"The lad here."
The kid had risen to his feet again. The ex-priest stood by him. The judge in the floor of the well likewise rose, and he adjusted his hat and gripped the valise under his arm like some immense and naked barrister whom the country had crazed.
"Weigh your counsel, priest," he said. "We are all here together. Yonder sun is like the eye of God, and we will cook impartially upon this great silicious griddle, I do assure you."
"I'm no priest, and I've no counsel," said Tobin. "The lad is a free agent."
The judge smiled.
"Quite so," he said.
He looked at Toadvine, and he smiled up at the ex-priest again.
"What then?" he said. "Are we to drink at these holes, turn about, like rival bands of apes?"
The ex-priest looked at the kid. They stood facing the sun. He squatted, the better to address the judge below.
"Do you think that there is a registry where you can file on the wells of the desert?"
"Ah, priest, you know those offices more readily than I. I've no claim here. I've told you before, I'm a simple man. You know you're welcome to come down here and to drink and to fill your flask."
Tobin didn't move.
"Let me have the canteen," said the kid.
He had taken the pistol from his belt, and he handed it to the ex-priest and took the leather bottle and descended the bank. The judge followed him with his eyes. The kid circled the floor of the well, no part of which was altogether beyond the judge's reach, and he knelt opposite the imbecile and pulled the stopper from the flask and submerged the flask in the basin. He and the imbecile watched the water run in at the neck of the flask, and they watched it bubble, and they watched it cease. The kid stoppered the flask and leaned and drank from the pool, and then he sat back and looked at Toadvine.
"Are you going with us?"
Toadvine looked at the judge.
"I don't know," he said. "I'm subject to arrest. They'll arrest me in California."
"Arrest ye?"
Toadvine didn't answer. He was sitting in the sand, and he made a tripod of three fingers and stuck them in the sand before him, and then he lifted and turned them and poked them in again, so that there were six holes in the form of a star or a hexagon, and then he rubbed them out again. He looked up.
"You wouldn't think that a man would run plumb out of country out here, would you?"
The kid rose and slung the flask by its strap over his shoulder. His trouser leg was black with blood, and the bloody stump of the shaft jutted from his thigh like a peg for hanging implements upon. He spat and wiped his mouth with the back of his hand, and he looked at Toadvine.
"It ain't country you've run out of," he said.
Then he made his way across the sink and up the bank. The judge followed him with his eyes, and when the kid reached the sunlight at the top, he turned and looked back, and the judge was holding open the satchel between his naked thighs.
$500, he said. "Powder and ball included."
The ex-priest was at the kid's side.
"Do him,"
he hissed. The kid took the pistol, but the ex-priest clung to his arm, whispering. And when the kid pulled away, he spoke aloud. Such was his fear.
"You'll get no second chance, lad. Do it. He's naked. He's unarmed. God's blood, do you think you'll best him any other way? Do it, lad. Do it, for the love of God. Do it, or I swear your life is forfeit."
The judge smiled. He tapped his temple. "The priest," he said. "The priest has been too long in the sun. 750, that's my best offer. It's a seller's market." The kid put the pistol in his belt. Then, with the ex-priest at his elbow importunate, he circled the crater, and they set out west across the pan. Toadvine climbed up and watched them. After a while, there was nothing to see. That day, their way took them upon a vast mosaic pavement cobbled up from tiny blocks of jasper, carnelian, agate. 1,000 acres wide where the wind sang in the groutless interstices. Traversing this ground toward the east, riding one horse and leading another, came David Brown. The horse he led was saddled and bridled, and the kid stood with his thumbs in his belt and watched while he rode up and looked down at his old companions.
"We heard you were in the juzgado," said Tobin.
"I was," said Brown. "I ain't now."
His eyes catalogued them in every part. He looked at the piece of arrow shaft protruding from the kid's leg, and he looked into the ex-priest's eyes.
"Where's your outfits?" he said.
"You're looking at 'em."
"You fall out with Glanton?"
"Glanton's dead."
Brown spat a dry white spot in that vast and broken plateland. He had a small stone in his mouth against the thirst, and he shifted it with his jaw and looked at them.
"The Yumas," he said.
"Aye,"
said the ex-priest.
"All rubbed out?"
"Toadvine and the judge are at the well back yonder."
"The judge," said Brown.
The horses stared bleakly at the crazed stone floor whereon they stood.
"The rest gone under? Smith, Dorsey, the nigger?"
"All,"
said Tobin. Brown looked east across the desert.
"How far to the well?"
"We left about an hour past daybreak."
"Is he armed?"
"He is not."
He studied their faces.
"The priests don't lie," he said.
No one spoke. He sat fingering the scapular of dried ears. Then he turned the horse and rode on, leading the riderless animal behind. He rode, watching back at them. Then he stopped again.
"Did you see him dead?" he called. "Glanton?"
"I did,"
called the ex-priest, for he had so. He rode on, turned slightly in the saddle, the rifle on his knee. He kept watch behind him on those pilgrims, and they on him. When he was well diminished on the pan, they turned and went on. By noon the day following, they had begun to come again upon abandoned gear from the caravans, cast shoes and pieces of harness and bones and the dried carcasses of mules with the alparejas still buckled about. They trod the faint arc of an ancient lakeshore, where broken shells lay like bits of pottery, frail and ribbed among the sands, and in the early evening they descended among a series of dunes and spoil banks to Carrizo Creek, a seep that welled out of the stones and ran off down the desert and vanished again. Thousands of sheep had perished here, and the travelers made their way among the yellowed bones and carcasses with their rags of tattered wool, and they knelt among the bones to drink. When the kid raised his dripping head from the water, a rifle ball dished his reflection from the pool, and the echoes of the shot clattered about the bone-strewn slopes and clanged away in the desert and died. He spun on his belly and clambered sideways, scanning the skyline. He saw the horses first, standing nose to nose in a notch among the dunes to the south. He saw the judge, clad in the gusseted clothing of his recent associates. He was holding the mouth of the upright rifle in his fist and pouring powder from a flask down the bore. The imbecile, naked save for a hat, squatted in the sands at his feet. The kid scuttled to a low place in the ground and lay flat, with the pistol in his fist and the creek trickling past his elbow. He turned to look for the ex-priest, but he could not find him. He could see through the lattice of bones the judge and his charge on the hill in the sun, and he raised the pistol and rested it in the saddle of a rancid pelvis and fired. He saw the sand jump on the slope behind the judge, and the judge leveled the rifle and fired, and the rifle ball whacked through the bones, and the shots rolled away over the dunelands. The kid lay with his heart hammering in the sand. He thumbed back the hammer again and raised his head. The idiot sat as before, and the judge was trudging sedately along the skyline, looking over the wind-rowed bones below him for an advantage. The kid began to move again. He moved into the creek on his belly and lay drinking, holding up the pistol and the powder flask and sucking at the water. Then he moved out the far side and down a trampled corridor through the sands where wolves had gone to and fro. Off to his left, he thought he heard the ex-priest hiss at him, and he could hear the creek, and he lay listening. He set the hammer at half-cock and rotated the cylinder and recharged the empty chamber and capped the piece and raised up to look. The shallow ridge along which the judge had advanced was empty, and the two horses were coming toward him across the sand to the south. He cocked the pistol and lay watching. They approached freely over the barren pitch, nudging the air with their heads, their tails whisking. Then he saw the idiot shambling along behind them, like some dim, Neolithic herdsman. To his right, he saw the judge appear from the dunes and reconnoiter, and drop from sight again. The horses continued on, and there was a scrabbling behind him, and when the kid turned, the ex-priest was in the corridor hissing at him.
"Shoot him!"
he called. The kid spun about to look for the judge, but the ex-priest called again in his hoarse whisper,
"The fool! Shoot the fool!"
He raised his pistol. The horses stepped one and the next through a break in the yellowed palings, and the imbecile shambled after and disappeared. He looked back at Tobin, but the ex-priest was gone. He moved along the corridor until he came to the creek again, already slightly roiled from the drinking horses above him. His leg had begun to bleed, and he lay soaking it in the cold water, and he drank and palmed water over the back of his neck. The marblings of blood that swung from his thigh were like thin red leeches in the current. He looked at the sun.
"Hello!"
called the judge, his voice off to the west, as if there were new riders to the creek, and he addressed them. The kid lay listening. There were no new riders. After a while, the judge called out again.
"Come out," he called. "There's plenty of water for everybody."
The kid had swung the powder flask around to his back to keep it out of the creek, and he held the pistol up and waited. Upstream, the horses had stopped drinking. Then they started drinking again. When he moved out on the far side of the creek, he came upon the hand and foot tracks left by the ex-priest among the prints of cats and foxes and the little desert pigs. He entered a clearing in that senseless midden and sat listening. His leather clothes were heavy and stiff with water, and his leg was throbbing. A horse's head came up streaming water at the muzzle 100 feet away over the bones and dropped from sight again. When the judge called out, his voice was in a new place. He called out for them to be friends. The kid watched a small caravan of ants bearing off among the arches of sheep ribs. In the watching, his eyes met the eyes of a small viper coiled under a flap of hide. He wiped his mouth and began to move again. In a cul-de-sac, the tracks of the ex-priest terminated and came back. He lay listening. It was hours till dark. After a while, he heard the idiot slobbering somewhere among the bones. He heard the wind coming in off the desert, and he heard his own breathing. When he raised his head to look out, he saw the ex-priest stumbling among the bones and holding aloft a cross he'd fashioned out of the shins of a ram, and he'd lashed them together with strips of hide, and he was holding the thing before him like some mad dowser in the bleak of desert and calling out in a tongue both alien and extinct. The kid stood up, the revolver in both hands. He wheeled. He saw the judge, and the judge was in another quarter altogether, and he had the rifle already at his shoulder. When he fired, Tobin turned around, facing the way he'd come, and sat down, still holding the cross. The judge put down the rifle and took up another. The kid tried to steady the barrel of the pistol, and he let off the shot and then dropped to the sand. The heavy ball of the rifle passed overhead like an asteroid, and chattered and chopped among the bones fanned over the rise of ground beyond. He raised to his knees and looked for the judge, but the judge was not there. He reloaded the empty chamber and began to move again on his elbows toward the spot where he'd seen the ex-priest fall, taking his bearings by the sun and pausing from time to time to listen. The ground was trampled with the tracks of predators come in from the plains for the carrion, and the wind carrying through the breaks bore with it a sour reek, like the stink of a rancid dishclout, and there was no sound except the wind anywhere at all. He found Tobin kneeling in the creek, bathing his wound with a piece of linen torn from his shirt. The ball had passed completely through his neck. It had narrowly missed the carotid artery, yet he could not make the blood to stop. He looked at the kid, crouched among the skulls and upturned ribtines.
"You've got to kill the horses," he said. "You've no other chance out of here. He'll ride you down." "We could take the horses." "Don't be a fool, lad. What other bait has he?" "We can get out of here as soon as it comes dark. Do you think there'll be no day again?"
The kid watched him.
"Will it not stop?" he said. "It will not." "What do you think?" "I've got to stop it."
The blood was running between his fingers.
"Where's the judge?" said the kid.
"Where, indeed?"
"If I kill him, we can take the horses." "You'll not kill him. Don't be a fool. Shoot the horses."
The kid looked off up the shallow, sandy creek.
"Go on, lad."
He looked at the ex-priest and at the slow gouts of blood dropping in the water, like rose blooms, how they swelled and were made pale. He moved away up the creek. When he came to where the horses had entered the water, they were gone. The sand on the side where they'd gone out was still wet. He pushed the revolver along before him, moving on the heels of his hands. For all his caution, he found the idiot watching him before he ever saw it. It was sitting motionless in a bower of bones, with the broken sunlight stenciled over its vacant face, and it was watching like a wild thing in a wood. The kid looked at it, and then he shoved on past in the tracks of the horses. The loose neck swiveled slowly, and the dull jaw drooled. When he looked back, it was still watching. Its wrists were lying in the sand before it, and although there was no expression to its face, yet it seemed a creature beset with a great woe. When he saw the horses, they were standing on a rise of ground above the creek and looking toward the west. He lay quietly and studied the terrain. Then he moved out along the edge of the wash and sat with his back to the bone salience and cocked the pistol and took a rest with his elbows on his knees. The horses had seen him come out of the wash, and they were watching him. When they heard the pistol cock, they pricked their ears and began to walk toward him across the sand. He shot the forward horse in the chest, and it fell over and lay breathing heavily, with the blood running out of its nose. The other one stopped and stood uncertainly, and he cocked the pistol and shot it as it turned. It began to trot among the dunes, and he shot it again, and its front legs buckled, and it pitched forward and rolled onto its side. It raised its head once, and then it lay still. He sat listening. Nothing moved. The first horse lay as it had fallen, the sand about its head darkening with blood. The smoke drifted away down the draw and thinned and vanished. He moved back down the wash and crouched under the ribs of a dead mule and recharged the pistol and then moved on toward the creek again. He did not go back the way he'd come, and he did not see the imbecile again. When he came to the creek, he drank and bathed his leg and lay listening as before.
"Throw that gun out now," said the judge.
He froze. The voice was not 50 feet away.
"I know what you've done. The priest put you up to it, and I'll take that as a mitigation in the act and the intent, which I would any man in his wrongdoing. But there's the question of property. You bring me the pistol now."
The kid lay without moving. He heard the judge wade the creek upstream. He lay counting slowly under his breath. When the roiled water reached him, he stopped counting and let go on the current a dry twist of grass and told it away downstream. At that same count, it was scarcely out of sight among the bones. He moved out of the water and looked at the sun and began to make his way back to where he'd left Tobin. He found the ex-priest's tracks still wet where he'd left the creek, and the way of his progress marked with blood. He followed through the sand until he came to that place where the ex-priest had circled upon himself and lay hissing at him from his place of cover.
"Did you do for them, lad?"
He raised his hand.
I heard the shots, all three. The fool as well, aye, lad?"
He didn't answer.
"Good lad,"
hissed the ex-priest. He'd bound up his neck in his shirt, and he was naked to the waist, and he squatted among those rancid pickets and eyed the sun. The shadows were long on the dunes, and in the shadow the bones of the beasts that had died there lay skewed in a curious congress of garbled armatures upon the sands. They'd close to 2 hours till dark, and the ex-priest said so. They lay under the board-like hide of a dead ox and listened to the judge calling to them. He called out points of jurisprudence. He cited cases. He expounded upon those laws pertaining to property rights in beast mansuit. And he quoted from cases of attainder, insofar as he reckoned them germane to the corruption of blood and the prior and felonious owners of the horses now dead among the bones. Then he spoke of other things. The ex-priest leaned to the kid.
"Don't listen," he said. "I ain't listening. Stop your ears. Stop yours."
The priest cupped his hands over his ears and looked at the kid. His eyes were bright from the blood loss, and he was possessed of a great earnestness.
"Do it," he whispered. "Do you think he speaks to me?"
The kid turned away. He marked the sun squatting at the western rim of the waste, and they spoke no more until it was dark. And then they rose and made their way out. They stole up from the basin and set off across the shallow dunes, and they looked a last time back at the valley where, flickering in the wind at the edge of the revetment, stood the judge's night fire for all to see. They didn't speculate as to what it fed upon for fuel, and they were well advanced on the desert before the moon rose. There were wolves and jackals in that region, and they cried all the fore part of the night until the moon came up, and then they ceased as if surprised by its rising. Then they began again. The pilgrims were weak from their wounds. They lay down to rest, but never for long, and never without scanning the skyline to the east for any figure intruded upon it. And they shivered in the barren desert wind coming out of whatever godless quadrant, cold and sterile, and bearing news of nothing at all. When day came, they made their way to a slight rise on that endless flat, and squatted in the loose shale, and watched the sun's rising. It was cold, and the ex-priest in his rags and his collar of blood hugged himself. On this small promontory they slept, and when they woke it was mid-morning, and the sun well advanced. They sat up and looked out. Coming toward them, over the plain, in the middle distance, they could see the figure of the judge, the figure of the fool. Chapter 21. Desert Castaways. The Backtrack. A Hideout. The Wind Takes a Side. The Judge Returns. An Address. Los Digueños. San Felipe. Hospitality of the Savages. Into the Mountains. Grizzlies. San Diego. The Sea. The kid looked at Tobin, but the ex-priest sat without expression. He was drawn and wretched-looking, and the approaching travelers seemed to evoke in him no recognition. He raised his head slightly, and he spoke without looking at the kid. "Go on," he said. "Save yourself." The kid took the water bottle from the shales and unstoppered it and drank and handed it across. The ex-priest drank. And they sat watching, and then they rose and turned and set out again. They were much reduced by their wounds and their hunger, and they made a poor show as they staggered onward. By noon their water was gone, and they sat studying the barrenness about. A wind blew down from the north. The mouths were dry. The desert upon which they were entrained was desert absolute, and it was devoid of feature altogether, and there was nothing to mark their progress upon it. The earth fell away on every side equally in its architecture, and by these limits were they circumscribed, and of them were they locusts. They rose and went on. The sky was luminous. There was no trace to follow other than the bits of cast-off left by travelers, even to the bones of men drifted out of their graves in the scalloped sands. In the afternoon the terrain began to rise before them, and at the crest of a shallow esker they stood and looked back to see the judge, much as before, some 2 miles distant on the plain. They went on. The approach to any watering place in that desert was marked by the carcasses of perished animals in increasing number, and so it was now, as if the wells were ringed about by some hazard lethal to creatures. The travelers looked back. The judge was out of sight beyond the rise. Before them lay the whitened boards of a wagon, and further on the shapes of mule and ox, with the hide scoured bald as canvas by the constant abrasion of the sand. The kid stood studying this place, and then he backtracked some 100 yards and stood looking down at his shallow footprints in the sand. He looked upon the drifted slope of the esker which they had descended, and he knelt and held his hand against the ground, and he listened to the faint silica hiss of the wind. When he lifted his hand, there was a thin ridge of sand that had drifted against it, and he watched this ridge slowly vanish before him. The ex-priest, when he returned to him, presented a grave appearance. The kid knelt and studied him where he sat. "We gotta hide," he said.
"Hide?"
"Yes."
"Where do you aim to hide?"
"Here. We'll hide here."
"You can't hide, lad."
"We can hide."
"You think he can't follow your track?"
"The wind's taking it. It's gone from the slope yonder."
"Gone?
Every trace?"
The ex-priest shook his head.
"Come on, we gotta get going."
"You can't hide."
"Get up."
The ex-priest shook his head.
"Ah, lad," he said.
"Get up," said the kid.
"Go on, go on."
He waved his hand.
The kid spoke to him.
He ain't nothing. You told me so yourself. Men are made of the dust of the earth. You said it was no
parable.
No parable. That it was a naked fact, and the judge was a man like all men.
Face him down, then, said the ex-priest. Face him down, if he is so.
And him with a rifle, and me with a pistol? Him with two rifles? Get up from there.
Tobin rose. He stood unsteadily. He leaned against the kid. They set out, veering off from the drifted track and down past the wagon. They passed the first of the racks of bones and went on to where a pair of mules lay dead in the traces. And here the kid knelt with a piece of board and began to scoop them a shelter, watching the skyline to the east as he worked. Then they lay prone in the lee of those sour bones like sated scavengers, and awaited the arrival of the judge and the passing of the judge, if he would so pass. They'd not long to wait. He appeared upon the rise and paused momentarily before starting down, he and his drooling mansible. The ground before him was drifted and rolling, and although it could be fairly reconnoitered from the rise, the judge did not scan the country, nor did he seem to miss the fugitives from his purview. He descended the ridge and started across the flats, the idiot before him on a leather lead. He carried the two rifles that had belonged to Brown, and he wore a pair of canteens crossed upon his chest, and he carried a powder horn and flask and his portmanteau and a canvas rucksack that must have belonged to Brown also. More strangely, he carried a parasol made from rotted scraps of hide stretched over a framework of rib bones, bound with strips of tug. The handle had been the foreleg of some creature, and the judge approaching was clothed in little more than confetti, so rent was his costume to accommodate his figure. Bearing before him that morbid umbrella, with the idiot in its rawhide collar pulling at the lead, he seemed some degenerate entrepreneur fleeing from a medicine show and the outrage of the citizens who'd sacked it. They advanced across the flats, and the kid on his belly in the sand wallow watched them through the ribs of the dead mules. He could see his own tracks and Tobin's coming across the sand, dim and rounded, but tracks for that. And he watched the judge, and he watched the tracks, and he listened to the sand moving on the desert floor. The judge was perhaps 100 yards out when he stopped and surveyed the ground. The idiot squatted on all fours and leaned into the lead like some naked species of lemur. It swung its head and sniffed at the air, as if it were being used for tracking. It had lost its hat, or perhaps the judge had replevined it, for he now wore a rough and curious pair of pampooties cut from a piece of hide and strapped to the soles of his feet with wrappings of hemp salvaged from some desert wreck. The imbecile lunged in its collar and croaked, its forearms dangling at its chest. When they passed the wagon and continued on, the kid knew they were beyond the point where he and Tobin had turned off from the trace. He looked at the tracks, faint shapes that backed across the sands and vanished. The ex-priest at his side seized his arm and hissed and gestured toward the passing judge, and the wind rattled the scraps of hide at the carcass, and the judge and the idiot passed on across the sands and disappeared from sight. They lay without speaking. The ex-priest raised himself slightly and looked out, and he looked at the kid. The kid lowered the hammer of the pistol.
"You'll get no such chance as that again."
The kid put the pistol in his belt and rose onto his knees and looked out.
"And what now?"
The kid didn't answer.
"He'll be waiting at the next well." "Let him wait. We could go back to the creek." "And do what?" "Wait for a party to come through." "Through from where? There ain't no ferry." "There's game comes to the creek."
Tobin was looking out through the bones and hide. When the kid didn't answer, he looked up.
"We could go there," he said. "I got 4 rounds, the kid said.
He rose and looked out across the scavenged ground, and the ex-priest rose and looked with him. What they saw was the judge returning. The kid swore and dropped to his belly. The ex-priest crouched. They pushed down into the wallow, and with their chins in the sand like lizards, they watched the judge traverse again the grounds before them. With his leashed fool and his equipage, and the parasol dripping in the wind like a great black flower, he passed among the wreckage until he was again upon the slope of the Sand Esker. At the crest he turned, and the imbecile squatted at his knees, and the judge lowered the parasol before him and addressed the countryside about.
"The priest has led you to this, boy. I know you would not hide. I know, too, that you've not the heart of a common assassin. I've passed before your gun sights twice this hour, and will pass a third time. Why not show yourself?" "No assassin," called the judge, "and no partisan either. There's a flawed place in the fabric of your heart. Do you think I could not know? You alone were mutinous. You alone reserved in your soul some corner of clemency for the heathen."
The imbecile stood and raised its hands to its face and yammered weirdly and sat again.
"You think I've killed Brown and Toadvine? They are alive as you and me. They are alive and in possession of the fruits of their election. Do you understand? Ask the priest. The priest knows. The priest does not lie."
The judge raised the parasol and adjusted his parcels.
"Perhaps," he called, "perhaps you have seen this place in a dream, that you would die here."
Then he descended the esker and passed once more across the boneyard, led by the tethered fool, until the two were shimmering and insubstantial in the waves of heat, and then they were gone altogether. They would have died if the Indians had not found them. All the early part of the night they'd kept Sirius at their left on the southwest horizon, and Cetus out there fording the void, and Orion and Betelgeuse turning overhead, and they had slept curled and shivering in the darkness of the plains, and woke to find the heavens all changed, and the stars by which they'd traveled not to be found, as if their sleep had encompassed whole seasons. In the auburn dawn, they saw the half-naked savages crouched or standing all in a row along a rise to the north. They got up and went on, their shadows so long and so narrow, raising with mock stealth each thin articulated leg. The mountains to the west were whited out against the daybreak. The aborigines moved along the sand ridge. After a while, the ex-priest sat down, and the kid stood over him with the pistol, and the savages came down from the dunes and approached by starts and checks across the plain like painted sprites. They were degenuous. They were armed with short bows, and they drew about the travelers and knelt and gave them water out of a gourd. They'd seen such pilgrims before, and with sufferings more terrible. They eked a desperate living from that land, and they knew that nothing, excepting some savage pursuit, could drive men to such plight. And they watched each day for that thing to gather itself out of its terrible incubation in the house of the sun and muster along the edge of the eastern world, and whether it be armies or plague or pestilence or something altogether unspeakable, they waited with a strange equanimity. They led the refugees into their camp at San Felipe, a collection of crude huts made from reeds, and housing a population of filthy and beggarly creatures, dressed largely in the cotton shirts of the Argonauts who'd passed there. Shirts and nothing more. They fetched them a stew of lizards and pocket mice, hot in clay bowls, and a sort of pignoli made from dried and pounded grasshoppers. And they crouched about and watched them with great solemnity as they ate. One reached and touched the grips of the pistol in the kid's belt and drew back again.
"Pistola,"
he said. The kid ate. The savages nodded.
"Quiero mirar su pistola,"
the man said. The kid didn't answer. When the man reached for the pistol, he intercepted his hand and put it from him. When he turned loose, the man reached again, and the kid pushed his hand away again. The man grinned. He reached a third time. The kid set the bowl between his legs and drew the pistol and cocked it and put the muzzle against the man's forehead. They sat quite still. The others watched. After a while, the kid lowered the pistol and let down the hammer and put it in his belt and picked up the bowl and commenced eating again. The man gestured toward the pistol and spoke to his friends, and they nodded, and then they sat as before.
¿Qué pasó con ustedes?
The kid watched the man over the rim of the bowl with his dark and hollow eyes. The Indian looked at the ex-priest.
¿Qué pasó con ustedes?
The ex-priest in his black and crusted cravat turned his whole torso to look at the man who'd spoken. He looked at the kid. He'd been eating with his fingers, and he licked them and wiped them on the filthy leg of his trousers.
Las yumas, he said.
They sucked in air and clucked their tongues.
Son muy malos, said the speaker. Claro. ¿No tiene compañeros?
The kid and the ex-priest eyed each other.
Sí, said the kid. Muchos.
He waved his hand to the east.
Llegarán. Muchos compañeros.
The Indians received this news without expression. A woman brought more of the pignoli, but they had been without food too long to have appetites, and they waved her away. In the afternoon they bathed in the creek and slept on the ground. When they woke, they were being watched by a group of naked children and a few dogs. When they went up through the camp, they saw the Indians sitting along a ledge of rock, watching tirelessly the land to the east for whatever might come out of it. No one spoke to them of the judge, and they didn't ask. The dogs and children followed them out of the camp, and they took the trail up into the low hills to the west, where the sun was already going. They reached Warner's ranch late the following day, and they restored themselves at the hot sulfur springs there. There was no one about. They moved on. The country to the west was rolling and grassy, and beyond were mountains running to the coast. They slept that night among dwarf cedars, and in the morning the grass was frozen. And they could hear the wind in the frozen grass, and they could hear the cries of birds that seemed a charm against the sullen shores of the void out of which they had ascended. All that day they climbed through a highland park forested with Joshua trees and rimmed about by bald granite peaks. In the evening flocks of eagles went up through the pass before them, and they could see on those grassy benches the great shambling figures of bears, like cattle, grazing on some upland heath. There were skifts of snow in the lee of the stone ledges, and in the night a light snow fell upon them. Reefs of mist were blowing across the slopes when they set out shivering in the dawn, and in the new snow they saw the tracks of the bears that had come down to take their wind just before daylight. That day there was no sun, only a paleness in the haze, and the country was white with frost, and the shrubs were like polar isomers of their own shapes. Wild rams ghosted away up those rocky draws, and the wind swirled down cold and gray from the snowy reeks above them, a smoking region of wild vapors blowing down through the gap as if the world up there were all afire. They spoke less and less between them until at last they were silent altogether, as is often the way with travelers approaching the end of a journey. They drank from the cold mountain streams and bathed their wounds, and they shot a young doe at a spring and ate what they could, and smoked thin sheets of the meat to carry with them. Although they saw no more bears, they saw sign of their vicinity, and they moved off over the slopes a good mile from their meat camp before they put down for the night. In the morning, they crossed a bed of thunderstones clustered on that heath like the ossified eggs of some primal ground bird. They trod the shadow line under the mountains, keeping just in the sun for the warmth of it, and that afternoon they first saw the sea, far below them, blue and serene under clouds. The trail went down through the low hills and picked up the wagon track, and they followed where the locked wheels had skidded and the iron tires scarred the rock, and the sea down there darkened to black, and the sun fell, and all the land about went blue and cold. They slept shivering under a wooded boss among owl cries and a scent of juniper, while the stars swarmed in the bottomless night. It was evening of the following day when they entered San Diego. The ex-priest turned off to find them a doctor, but the kid wandered on through the raw mud streets and out past the houses of hide in their rows and across the gravel strand to the beach. Loose strands of amber-colored kelp lay in a rubbery rack at the tideline. A dead seal. Beyond the inner bay, part of a reef in a thin line, like something foundered there on which the sea was teething. He squatted in the sand and watched the sun on the hammered face of the water. Out there, island clouds emplaned upon a salmon-colored other sea. Seafowl in silhouette. Downshore, the dull surf boomed. There was a horse standing there, staring out upon the darkening waters, and a young colt that cavorted and trotted off and came back. He sat watching while the sun dipped, hissing in the swells. The horse stood darkly against the sky. The surf boomed in the dark, and the sea's black hide heaved in the cobbled starlight, and the long pale combers loped out of the night and broke along the beach. He rose and turned toward the lights of the town. The tide pools bright as smelter pots among the dark rocks where the phosphorescent sea crabs clambered back. Passing through the salt grass, he looked back. The horse hadn't moved. A ship's light winked in the swells. The colt stood against the horse with its head down, and the horse was watching out there past men's knowing, where the stars are drowning and whales ferry their vast souls through the black and seamless sea. Chapter 22. Under arrest. The judge pays a call. An arraignment. Soldier, priest, magistrate. On his own recognizance. He sees a surgeon. The arrow shaft removed from his leg. Delirium. He journeys to Los Angeles. A public hanging. Los Ahorcados. Looking for the ex-priest. Another fool. The scapular. To Sacramento. A traveler in the West. He abandons his party. The penitent brothers. The death cart. Another massacre. The Eldris in the rocks. Going back through the streets past the yellow window lights and barking dogs, he encountered a detachment of soldiers, but they took him for an older man in the dark and passed on. He entered a tavern and sat in a darkened corner watching the groups of men at the tables. No one asked him what he wanted in that place. He seemed to be waiting for someone to come for him. And after a while, four soldiers entered and arrested him. They didn't even ask his name. In his cell, he began to speak with a strange urgency of things few men have seen in a lifetime, and his jailers said that his mind had become uncottered by the acts of blood in which he had participated. One morning he woke to find the judge standing in his cage, hat in hand, smiling down at him. He was dressed in a suit of gray linen, and he wore new polished boots. His coat was unbuttoned, and in his waistcoat he carried a watch chain and a stick pin, and in his belt a leather-covered clip that held a small silver-mounted derringer, stocked in rosewood. He looked down the hallway of the crude mud building and donned the hat, and smiled again at the prisoner.
"Well," he said, "how are you?"
The kid didn't answer.
"They wanted to know from me if you were always crazy," said the judge. "They said it was the country. The country turned them out."
"Where's Tobin?"
"I told them that the Cretan had been a respected doctor of divinity from Harvard College as recently as March of this year. That his wits had stood him as far west as the Aquarius Mountains. It was the ensuing country that carried them off, together with his clothes."
"And Toadvine and Brown, where are they?"
"In the desert, where you left them. A cruel thing. Your companions in arms."
The judge shook his head.
"What do they aim to do with me?"
"I believe it is their intention to hang you."
"What did you tell them?"
"Told them the truth. That you were the person responsible. Not that we have all the details. But they understand that it was you and none other who shaped events along such a calamitous course, eventuating in the massacre at the ford by the savages with whom you conspired. Means and ends are of little moment here, idle speculations. But even though you carry the draft of your murderous plan with you to the grave, it will nonetheless be known in all its infamy to your maker. And as that is so, so shall it be made known to the least of men, all in the fullness of time."
"You're the one that's crazy," said the kid.
The judge smiled.
"No," he said, "it was never me. But why lurk there in the shadows? Come here, where we can talk, you and me."
The kid stood against the far wall, hardly more than a shadow himself.
"Come up," said the judge. "Come up, for I've yet more to tell you."
He looked down the hallway.
"Don't be afraid," he said. "I'll speak softly. It's not for the world's ears, but for yours only. Let me see you. Don't you know that I'd have loved you like a son?"
He reached through the bars.
"Come here," he said. "Let me touch you."
The kid stood with his back to the wall.
"Come here, if you're not afraid," whispered the judge.
"I ain't afraid of you."
The judge smiled. He spoke softly into the dim mud cubicle.
"You came forward," he said, "to take part in a work. But you were a witness against yourself. You sat in judgment on your own deeds. You put your own allowances before the judgments of history, and you broke with the body of which you were pledged a part, and poisoned it in all its enterprise. Hear me, man. I spoke in the desert for you, and you only, and you turned a deaf ear to me. If war is not holy, man is nothing but antique clay. Even the Cretan acted in good faith, according to his parts. For it was required of no man to give more than he possessed, nor was any man's share compared to another's. Only each was called upon to empty out his heart into the common, and one did not. Can you tell me who that one was?"
"It was you," whispered the kid. "You were the one."
The judge watched him through the bars. He shook his head.
"What joins men together," he said, "is not the sharing of bread, but the sharing of enemies. But if I was your enemy, With whom would you have shared me? With whom? The priest? Where is he now? Look at me. Our animosities were formed and waiting before ever we two met. Yet even so, you could have changed it all.
You, said the kid. It was you.
It was never me, said the judge. Listen to me. Do you think Glanton was a fool? Don't you know that he'd have killed you?
Lies, the kid said. Lies, by God, lies.
Think again, said the judge.
He never took part in your craziness.
The judge smiled. He took his watch from his waistcoat and opened it and held it to the failing light.
For even if you should have stood your ground, he said, yet what ground was it?
He looked up. He pressed the case shut and restored the instrument to his person.
Time to be going, he said. I have errands.
The kid closed his eyes. When he opened them, the judge was gone. That night he called the corporal to him, and they sat on either side of the bars while the kid told the soldier of the hoard of gold and silver coins hid in the mountains not far from this place. He talked for a long time. The corporal had set the candle on the floor between them, and he watched him, as one might watch a glib and lying child. When he was finished, the corporal rose and took the candle with him, leaving him in darkness. He was released 2 days later. A Spanish priest had come to baptize him and had flung water at him through the bars like a priest casting out spirits. An hour later, when they came for him, he grew giddy with fear. He was taken before the alcalde, and this man spoke to him in a fatherly manner in the Spanish language, and then he was turned out into the streets. The doctor that he found was a young man of good family from the East. He cut open his trouser leg with scissors and looked at the blackened shaft of the arrow and moved it about. A soft fistula had formed about it. "Do you have any pain?" he said. The kid didn't answer. He pressed about the wound with his thumb. He said that he could perform the surgery and that it would cost $100. The kid rose from the table and limped out. The day following, as he sat on the plaza, a boy came and led him again to the shack behind the hotel, and the doctor told him that they would operate in the morning. He sold the pistol to an Englishman for $40, and woke at dawn in a lot underneath some boards where he'd crawled in the night. It was raining, and he went down through the empty mud streets and hammered at the grocer's door until the man let him in. When he appeared at the surgeon's office, he was very drunk, holding onto the door jamb, a quart bottle half full of whiskey clutched in his hand. The surgeon's assistant was a student from Sinaloa, who had apprenticed himself here. An altercation ensued at the door until the surgeon himself came from the rear of the premises.
"You'll have to come back tomorrow," he said.
"I don't aim to be no soberer, then."
The surgeon studied him.
"All right," he said. "Let me have the whiskey."
He entered, and the apprentice shut the door behind him.
"You won't need the whiskey," said the doctor. "Let me have it."
"Why won't I need it?"
"We have spirits of ether. You won't need the whiskey."
"Is it stronger?"
"Much stronger. In any case, I can't operate on a man and him dead drunk."
He looked at the assistant, and then he looked at the surgeon. He set the bottle on the table.
"Good," said the surgeon. "I want you to go with Marcelo. He will draw you a bath and give you clean linen and show you to a bed."
He pulled his watch from his vest and held it in his palm and read it.
"It is 8:15. We'll operate at 1. Get some rest. If you require anything, please let us know."
The assistant led him across the courtyard to a whitewashed adobe building in the rear. a bay that held 4 iron beds, all empty. He bathed in a large riveted copper boiler that looked to have been salvaged from a ship, and he lay on the rough mattress and listened to children playing somewhere beyond the wall. He did not sleep. When they came for him, he was still drunk. He was led out.